Today is the next installment in the series of messages that we've been going through, looking at the book of Exodus from chapter 1 through chapter 12, which lead up to the Passover. And today we are going to look at the plagues upon Egypt. And there's a fair bit of material here. I'm not going to read it all. I'm going to basically try and focus on the dialogue. And if you're unfamiliar with the plagues upon Egypt, you can read more about that. Just basically read chapters 7 through 11 in Exodus. I'll be drawing out, maybe 50% of it. Just a lot of material. So I want to go through it and look at the plagues perhaps more from a thematic way instead of details on every last one of them. And I think of kind of got a new angle. I was mentioning I was going to do this to my wife, Laura, and she said, oh, you're going to do this. And I said, no. And she said, oh, you're going to do that. Because, you know, you've all heard messages about the plagues before. And I said, no, I'm going to do something different. So I don't know. It was not too different, I hope. But a way of looking at it that I haven't thought of myself. Others may have. So let's go to Exodus chapter 7. I'll put my ribbon in there. We're actually not going to go too many other places because we do have some territory to cover here. And let's read Exodus 7 verses 1 through 4 just to get started. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be your prophet. You are to say everything I command you, and your brother Aaron is to tell Pharaoh to let the Israelites go out of his country. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand upon Egypt with mighty acts of judgment. I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it. And Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded them. What happens first, before the plagues even begin, there's what I'm going to call an easy sign. Now let's just pick it up in verse 8 and read this little account here. It says, then the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, okay, when the Pharaoh says to you, perform a miracle, then say to Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh and it will become a snake. So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did just as the Lord commanded. And Aaron threw down his staff in front of Pharaoh and his officials and it became a snake. Pharaoh then summoned wise men, sorcerers, and the Egyptian magicians also did the same things by their secret arts. Each one of them threw down his staff, and it became a snake. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. Now, snake charming was a common trick in Egypt. You know, you've probably seen it on cartoons or something like that where, you know, there's someone and he's got a little pipe and the snake, you know, does his little tricks. And, you know, you've seen that. It's so, you know, commonly thought of. It's almost, yeah, it's a cartoon. So it was a common trick in Egypt. And, you know, it kind of it's not really a big surprise, I guess, that the magicians could do the same. So what's happening here is the negotiations are starting in this way, which kind of seems a little trivial compared to what is to come. We know the story, we know that where this is headed. This seems like kind of a trivial way to start things. However, I think what we can gather from this is that God's giving Pharaoh a sign, and God said, I'm going to harden this man's heart. He was giving him a sign that was very easy for him to dismiss. This would be one where the Pharaoh could say, hey, look, you know, my magicians, they can do the same stuff. So you've given me this sign, but, you know, the Egyptian religious figures, the magicians and so forth, they can do the same stuff. So why should I listen to you? And in this way, you know, God was making it easier for Pharaoh to harden his heart, which I've covered in the previous message, you know, looking at how Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And God kind of just provided the circumstances for this man to harden his heart. Because refusing God on little things, makes it easier to refuse God on more important matters. Now, we don't actually hear what Moses and Aaron say. There's no dialogue of their proclamation of God's demands to the Pharaoh. We don't really know, but we can assume that what they said was what God had told them to say. Let's go back to chapter 4, verse 23. God said, here's what I want you to say to this guy, this Pharaoh. And this will become more important, I think you'll see, as we go through the plagues. That's why I'm drawing it out. God is speaking to Moses and Aaron. He said, and I told you to go to Pharaoh and say this, let my son go so that he may worship me, the son being the people of Israel, my firstborn son. Let him go so that they may worship me. But you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son. You know, previously I'd talked about the importance of the firstborn son and why this was a big deal. What I'm getting at is that in the very first proclamation to Pharaoh, there would have been this inclusion of a threat. You know, hey, you know what? This is going to go badly, and it's going to end here. It's going this far, the death of your very own firstborn son. So Pharaoh was given a warning about, you know, where it's headed. And we'll see that comes into play as we move through. Now, I've done one of my awesome charts. They are awesome, aren't they? Yes. And this kind of takes a look at the plagues. And the colors don't show very well here, but I believe you've got three sets of plagues that work out here. The 10th one is special, but the first three sets have some characteristics. There's some that are given with warning and then followed with one with no warning. Right? See the pattern there? There's intensity, you know. The first ones start off being kind of annoying, then they start creating damage, and then they are really pointing at death. That's what they're about. Who's affected? You know, first everybody's affected, then Israel is exempt. That's interesting as well. We see that each time a plague is introduced, it's introduced by some sign that this is God, not just some natural occurrence. So Moses uses his staff, or he proclaims a word, or the time is predicted. And then there's the Pharaoh's heart. There's probably a lot more, but the bigger I made it, the smaller the type would get, and the less easy it would be for you to read. So Pharaoh, as I mentioned, had been warned that this confrontation would lead all the way up to the death of every Egyptian firstborn. That's where it was going to go unless he humbled himself and submitted to Yahweh, the living God. And each successive plague would be increasingly intense. And each successive plague would include a warning of the impending death, which was the real big deal, the death of the firstborn. I that's kind of where I'm coming from, looking at the plagues as these are all pointing towards the last plague, which is when things really get serious and bad. Now, the plagues also function as a message on other levels, and you've probably heard sermon about this at some point in the past. It's looking at nature, you know, and the Egyptians' worship of nature. It also deals with authority, you know, who has the authority to call these things out and make them happen. It also deals with God's power over these things. Okay, so the Egyptians, like most pagan type religions, had a pantheist outlook. And that means that to them, they saw the divine presence in the things of nature. So they would see God or the divine being in trees or within the animals or within the crops or the river. Sometimes even the natural processes like sex or the germination of seeds or storms, things like that. And they saw the divine presence in these natural things. There's a pantheist outlook. That's where we find God. We look to nature, and God's in there. God's a part of nature, is another way of putting it. Okay? And as it says in Romans 1, they worshipped and served created things. And Paul is writing there and speaking of all the false religions of the world. They worshiped and served created things, oblivious to the one who created all things. And the plagues introduced the people of Egypt to the one who made all things, the one who is the master over all nature, who has the authority and the power over all nature. Just to say it again in a different way, the living God is not in nature or a personification of natural forces, which again is what a lot of false religion is about. He's not in the rain, he's not in the sex act, he's not in the trees. He exists outside of nature, and he is able to command it and control it. And the plagues make this distinction very clear. In our day, we don't really think that way, and we don't think that we think that way, but in some ways we do. We have a slightly different but equally flawed view of nature. You know, and we're all about nature nowadays. We're all about biology, we're all about weather, the planet, you know, the solar system. We're all about the atoms and molecules. We're all about the physical world. And a big part of the philosophy of our day and age is the idea of evolution. You know, that everything just came from nature, right? That's a big part of what kids are taught in school. Well, the evolutionary philosophy, which is, you know, reaches deep down into our society, presents humans as merely a part of nature. You're just a thing. You're an animal. You just kind of developed out of this slime, and here you are. So you're part of nature, which is deceptive because it's partly true and it's partly false. Yes, we are part of nature. You know, pinch me. Yeah, I'm real. I'm part of nature. But we're more, and that's the part that's missing. We're part of nature, but we're more than that. We're made of the dust, as the scriptures say, right? But we also have a spiritual component placed within us. And in this way, as the scriptures say, God has created human beings in his own image. All right? And like him, we are designed and ordained. If you read closely through Genesis, the first two chapters, designed and ordained to exercise control and mastery over nature. So like God, our Father, our Creator, we are set apart from nature. We're in nature, we are, you know, natural beings, but we're also set apart from nature. We are set apart because of the spirit component that is in us. There are aspects to human beings that are, you know, simply beyond the explanations that can be offered by nature. You just can't explain some of the things that go on between and within human beings through talking about molecules and atoms. Try explaining love using molecules and atoms and physics. I don't think it's possible. That's a big part of what it means to be a human being. That's the spiritual side of human beings. So teaching and believing that human beings are brought about by natural processes also leads to all sorts of destructive, perverse, and oppressive behavior. Okay, let's get back to the plagues. Okay, a little bit of a sidebar there. The plagues upon Egypt, they were all natural phenomena. They all happened. They were stuff that happened in the land from time to time. It wasn't the first time that locusts came upon the land, or hail, or pestilence. All these things happened. They were all natural phenomenon. And skeptics of the scriptures will say, well, look, these things just happened, and it was a bad year for Egypt, and a bunch of people made up this whole thing about God doing this after the fact. That's a skeptical view, right? However, these natural forces are raised to the level of miracle through a couple of things. Three. One, they all begin and end with Moses or Aaron's public command, which is them serving God as agents. So each of them there is a sign, there's something they do, the staff, the word, the outstretched hand, the predicted time, that set these apart from just pure natural phenomenon. Secondly, they come in quick succession. Boom, 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 boom. Some of them out of season. Third, they come with unprecedented intensity. So these natural phenomena, they happen. You know, this is part of the cycle of life and all that stuff, but they're miracles because of the way God has orchestrated it. The plagues also demonstrate Yahweh, the living God's power and authority to judge and to punish. To judge and to punish. Now, when you look at the world that you live in, you don't really see a lot of judgment and punishment. There's some, you know, but what we see is kind of, it's not even-handed. It's not always just. You know, it happens out there, but it sometimes seems like it's out of control. You don't know which way it's going to go. For now, we don't experience God's judgment and God's punishment, which is righteous and true. And God does not intervene in every dispute over right and wrong. You know, if you're having a beef with your buddy, God doesn't, you know, appear and resolve it and say, you know, you're right and you're wrong. That's not how it works, is it? No, it's not. He doesn't even punish every murder or overturn every oppression, does he? No. Remember back to what I said about us being created in God's image? As beings given dominion over the earth, that is our responsibility. We're supposed to take care of that stuff. God expects us to judge righteous judgments. There are other factors involved in that, but for now, it's our responsibility. If we don't do it, it's on us. For now. For now. With Christ's return, that will usher in a new phase, a new era, a new way of doing things. When He and the resurrected first fruits will see to it that God's will is done on earth. And what God does for Israel through the plagues here offers a foretaste, if you will, of what lays ahead for all humanity. Even interestingly enough, the darkness that comes before the final kaboom. It's very interesting. What He's doing for them is a foretaste. Yeah, there's going to be judgment. You know, when you teach and preach and believe and live for the return of Christ, you know that there is a time of judgment. There's a time of punishment. There's a time of vengeance. And there's a time for crimes committed to be paid for. And God says, I'm going to deal with all this through Christ. There's also a time for redemption. And there's a time for freedom from bondage. And there's a time when God's will shall be done on earth. And the plagues in some way are a little foretaste of this. Now let's see. Let's look at the first plague. The death of the Nile. They all have a death thing going on here. Go with me to Exodus 7, where you probably are already. And I'm going to read verses 14 through 18, which say this. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is unyielding. He refuses to let the people go. So go to Pharaoh in the morning, as he goes out to the river, and confront him on the bank of the Nile, and take in your hand the staff that was changed into a snake. Then say to him, The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has sent me to say to you, Let my people go, so that they may worship me in the wilderness. But until now you have not listened. This is what the Lord says, By this you will know that I am the Lord. With the staff that is in my hand, I will strike the water of the Nile, and it will be changed into blood, and the fish of the Nile will die, and the river will stink, and the Egyptians will not be able to drink its water. So Pharaoh would be coming down. He did this every morning. He would come down to the river to pay homage to the river. You know, the great god, the river, he would come down. Sacred life is in the river, and they probably had some ceremony that he did or something like that. We really don't know. His refusal of God's demand, which had already come to him, you know, the snake thing, his refusal of God's demand triggers a punishment. Okay, there's a punishment coming. Moses, I won't read through all the details of it, but Moses, he takes his staff. You know, this is one of the signs of decree that I'm talking about. His staff, and boom, hits the river, and it turns into blood, okay? Demonstrating that it's by God's decree, not some natural occurrence. Ah, well, then it was a mudslide up in Ethiopia or something like that. And each plague has one of these signs of decree. Drop down to verse 22. It says here that, but the Egyptian magicians did the same thing by their secret arts. So they were also able to turn the water red like blood. And Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said. Instead, he turned and went into his palace, and he did not take even this into his heart. And the Egyptians had to dig along the river to get drinking water because they could not drink the water of the river. So once again, the magicians are able to replicate this miracle. However they did it, you know, whether it was some trickery that they had, or maybe they had, you know, help from demonic forces, don't know. But they were able to replicate this miracle. But what they did was not on the scale of what God did. I don't know, it doesn't say, but you kind of get this sense that, well, maybe they had a little pot of water and they turned it red. Okay, that's great. But, you know, God turned all the water in the whole country into blood. The fact that they could replicate it, though, I think was another way that God created a circumstance where Pharaoh would harden his own heart. Because it says he hardened his heart. His heart, it doesn't say God hardened his heart, but he hardened his heart because, well, you know, my magicians can do this as well. This is trickery. So for 7 days, this great life-giving river smelled, and I put it to you, it smelled like death. You know, dried, stinking blood, the fish are dying. Ew, everything just stank like death. And I put it to you that this is the first portend of the final plague of death. With each of the plagues, God is warning the Pharaoh and the people of Egypt, this is what will happen if you don't change your minds. Let's go to the second plague. Frogs everywhere. Let's pick it up in Exodus 8 and read verses 1 through 7. It says that for 7 days, 7 days passed after the Lord struck the Nile, and then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, this is what the Lord says, let my people go so that they may worship me. And if you refuse to let them go, I will send a plague of frogs on your whole country. And the Nile will teem with frogs, and they'll come up into your palace and into your bedroom and into your bed and into the houses of your officials and on your people and in your ovens and kneading troughs, and the frogs will come up upon you and your people and all your officials. And then the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the streams and canals and ponds and make frogs come up on the land of Egypt. So Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came up and covered the land. But the magicians did the same thing by their secret arts, and they also made frogs come up on the land. In Egyptian culture, Egyptian religion, frogs were, get this, a symbol of fertility. Yeah, they were a symbol of fertility. Maybe because, you know, frogs, I think the mama frog lays like 100,000 eggs and there's just frogs everywhere. And I don't know. Maybe that was why, but for whatever reason, they were a symbol of fertility in Egypt. The goddess Hekt, H-E-K-T is the way we do it with our alphabet. The goddess Hekt was often portrayed as a midwife. And, you know, I tried one of those Egyptian carvings showed her as a midwife. It wasn't very distinct. It didn't look good as a slide, but, you know, she was involved in the process of birth. Especially the end of the birth, where they wanted the child to be born healthy and strong, and Hekt was involved. She was a midwife. So, long story short, frogs were sacred in Egypt, and they weren't supposed to kill them because this is a symbol of fertility. And they would, you know, they'd have little rings and amulets and things like that. Pregnant women would wear them so that everything would go well with their pregnancy and so forth. But now they were going to be everywhere, right? They were coming up. They were going to be in everything, on everything. I mean, imagine if the ground was covered with frogs, it'd be hard not to kill them, right? Because you'd step on them, crush them. And that would be kind of revolting to the Egyptians because they weren't supposed to kill frogs. This is bad. Hekt will be mad. So it was very, you know, upsetting to them they'd be stepping on these frogs. Let's read verses 8 through 10. It says, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, okay, what? The frogs are driving us crazy. Pray to the Lord to take the frogs away from me and my people, and I will let your people go to offer sacrifice to the Lord. Moses said to Pharaoh, I will leave you the honor of setting the time for me to pray for you and your officials and your people, that you and your homes may be rid of the frogs, except for those that remain in the Nile. Tomorrow, the Pharaoh said. So Pharaoh now acknowledges this Yahweh is a bona fide God. Okay, it's a real God. So pray to your God for me and get rid of these frogs. So that's a step forward, kind of. And Moses has Pharaoh pick the time. He says, so you pick the time when the frogs disappear. Let me know when you want this to happen. And why does he do that? I think he's doing that to show that this isn't just like, you know, a cycle of frogs and it, you know, kind of coincidentally went away. No, this is by decree. God is in charge. You tell me when, and that's when they will go away. Not a coincidence. So the frogs die. You know, they were everywhere. They die, and they had to pile them up in big piles, you know, get them out of everything, put them in big piles. And the piles of dead frogs started stinking. Again, the stench of death was the, you know, the end of the plague. It stank like death. What's the message? Well, I think it's partly I, the living God, Yahweh, I am the one in charge of the life cycle, and I can affect your life cycle for good or for bad. Again, pointing towards the final plague, I can reach into your homes. You know, I can reach into every corner of your life. I am the power of life and of death. So Moses intervenes, the crisis passes, and Pharaoh once again hardens his heart. And he goes back on his agreement to release Israel. Next plague, lice. You might read gnats in your Bible, but I think it's lice. So the third plague, lice on your bodies. Previously, you know, it was the river, then it was your homes, and now it's your very own body. Lice are unleashed without any warning because the Pharaoh's gone back on his word. It says in verse 19, but when the magicians tried to produce gnats by their secret arts, they could not. And the magicians said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. We can't do this. This is God. This is a God doing this. But Pharaoh's heart was hard and he wouldn't listen. So something's a little different, this one, than they couldn't do this. If you've ever had an infestation of lice, and if you've had children, you probably had lice as a problem in your home. It seems to really affect girls a lot more because they wear their hair longer. You know, it happened to us. My wife would be very embarrassed. It's a good thing she's not here. Because, you know, you get lice in your home and you think, well, people will think I'm dirty. No, it's just because my daughter tried on someone's hat in a store and it had lice in it. That's how she got lice. And it's everywhere. You know, and you look in the hair and it's crawling all over and it's just, it's so disgusting. It is everywhere. And you can feel it on your, oh, yuck. And every time, you know, you have natural little itches, you know, and I don't think lice are on me, but I feel like lice are on me. It's just gross. They're everywhere. They're on your flesh. And they're all over you. They're crawling on your skin. The message I think here is, okay, God affected your lands. He affected your river. He invaded your homes and kitchens and bedrooms with these frogs. He can touch your own flesh and blood as well. Next plague, the fourth plague. Okay, the fourth plague. Let's just read verse 24. Well, the fourth plague is the plague of flies. And the first set of three plagues, okay, set number one, they were annoying. They were unpleasant. The next three plagues, they actually inflict actual damage. So God had started off with these plagues that, you know, they were irritating, they were annoying. Okay, Pharaoh's still saying no, no, no. Now the plagues ramp up a little bit. Now things are really going to start getting damaged. So verse 24, let's just jump there. It says, "And the Lord said this, dense swarms of flies poured into Pharaoh's palace and into the house of his officials throughout Egypt, and the land was ruined by the flies." Now, I don't know how the flies would ruin the land, but that's what it says. Maybe they meant beetles. Maybe the translation is not so good. I would probably think it was beetles, not flies, but I don't know. So the scriptures say the land is being damaged by what's happening now. So let's go back to verse 22, where it says, okay, "But on that day I will deal differently with the land of Goshen, where my people live. No swarm of flies will be there, so that you will know that I, the Lord, am in this land. I will make a distinction between my people and your people, and this sign will occur tomorrow." So here's another thing that starts changing with the plagues, with the second set. Israel is now exempt. This will come into play when we get all the way up to the 10th plague. And God says, all right, I'm going to show you something. I'm going to afflict you, because up until now, the plagues appear to have affected everybody. He says, now it's not going to happen to my people. They're going to be exempt from all this stuff, and it's going to mean something to you. Pay attention. There'll be a separation between them and the Egyptians. The chosen people, the punishments will not come upon God's chosen people. That is, of course, a foretaste of the 10th plague. And I think it goes even beyond that. God's chosen people, where they're protected by God. We'll talk a little bit more about that at the Passover. If we're thinking of all these plagues as leading up to the 10th plague, they're kind of getting a foretaste here. The firstborn of my people will not be subject to death. So once again, I think this plague is pointing towards the final 10th plague. God says Israel's exempt. So when this starts coming, Israel's not going to be affected by it. One more little tidbit from this particular plague. Go to Exodus 8, and we're still with the flies. And let's pick it up in verse 25 through 29. It says, "Then Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron, and he said, 'Go, sacrifice to your Lord here in the land. Do it here in Egypt.'" You know, I'm going to agree to doing the sacrifice, but just do it here, okay? Don't go off into the wilderness. And Moses said, "Well, that will not be right. The sacrifices that we offer the Lord our God would be detestable to the Egyptians. And if we offer sacrifices that are detestable in their eyes, won't they stone us? I mean, this could lead to violence. We must take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifice to the Lord our God as he commanded us." Oh, that's important. As he commanded us. Not the way you say. We're going to do it the way God told us to. And Pharaoh said, "Okay, I will let you go offer sacrifices to the Lord your God in the wilderness, but don't go very far." Okay? Don't go very far. "And Moses answered, 'As soon as I leave you, I will pray to the Lord, and tomorrow the flies will leave Pharaoh and his officials and his people. Only let Pharaoh be sure that he does not act deceitfully again by not letting the people go to offer sacrifices to the Lord.'" So he's warning him, you know, don't keep doing this. This is bad. So Pharaoh agrees, but he still wants to dictate his own terms. You know, he says, "All right, you can go, but don't go very far." Seems kind of silly, but he wants to dictate his own terms, trying to save face, I guess. He says, "You know, you can just worship your God here. You know, I'm going to make some changes. You know what God said, but let's make some changes. Let's have a compromise." Okay. And, you know, Moses replies, "Look, no, can't do this." And a little bit of detail here. He says, "Our worship and service to Yahweh is incompatible with Egyptian religion." And it was, and it would lead to violence, there'd be problems. Egyptians actually regarded sheep and rams as sacred animals, and so killing them was not allowed. It was illegal. So if they started sacrificing all these sheep and rams in the presence of the Egyptians, it could lead to social unrest and violence. Very practical, but that's not the only reason. I don't believe that's the only reason. I put it to you that true worship and service to God cannot be mixed with pagan scruples. You know, that if they had decided to do this in Egypt, they might have said, "Well, you know, you have to do it this way because otherwise you'll offend us Egyptians." And God's true worship of God, just can't be mixed or compromised by pagan scruples. It just can't. The two don't mix, and that's true today as much as it was back then. They just don't mix. Well, what happens is the Pharaoh, he caves, but he's still trying to dictate terms by saying, okay, but don't go very far. Then the flies disappear, and Pharaoh once again hardens his heart. So even though he's warned by Moses, he goes back on it, and he hardens his heart again, and he changes and says, okay, I know I said that, but hey, no. So let's go to the next plague, the fifth plague, death of your livestock. Things are starting to get more intense. More real damage is happening now. It's not just annoying. God does not take pleasure in killing things and destroying life. But sometimes it's necessary. And he wants everyone to know, in this circumstance, that their choices have consequences. Okay, what you're deciding has consequences. But they don't feel the full brunt and wrath of God's annoyance and anger at Pharaoh and Egypt refusing his demand. He, if you think about it, with these plagues, he's being very patient. And he's kind of ratcheting them up and saying, look, I'm going to make it a little more intense. You're not getting it. You're not understanding. So I'm going to turn the dial up a little bit here. Now what's going to happen is all your herd animals are going to be affected by pestilence, and bad stuff is going to happen. You know, they've been told that the ultimate punishment of death on the firstborn is out there hanging over their heads. And they're being warned. They're being warned of that because the choices that they're making are going to end up there if you're not careful. So the Egyptians, you know, if you think about it, they would have had a closer connection to the animals of the herd, you know, the sheep that they kept in their pen, or, you know, if they had a little farm or something like that, you know, and they got to know the sheep or whatever. And people do that. They get a connection with their sheep. I mean, I know people who keep goats and they tell their kids, don't give the goats a name, right? Then you get attached to them, but the goats are there for us to, you know, eat. So there's a potential that they had more of a connection to their animals, the herd animals, than they did to other animals like fish or frogs or flies or anything like that. So the idea of death is coming a little closer. It's getting a little closer to the heart here. And if you read verse 7 of chapter 9, it says that the Pharaoh investigated and found out that not even one of the animals of the Israelites had died. Yet his heart was unyielding, and he would not let the people go. So he goes out, he wants to verify, yeah, Israel's not being affected. But his heart didn't change. Okay, the next plague, boils on your flesh. So like the third plague that ended the first set of three, remember my chart? This one comes without any warning because of what the Pharaoh's done. I mean, you know, you're breaking your word. This one comes without any warning. There's no audience with Pharaoh. There's no further negotiation on this one. It just happens, just like the lice. The sixth plague of boils ends the second set of three. And there's a sort of parallelism there. And here it's showing that God can bring damage and pain to your own flesh. Remember the lice, you know, and God said, I can get in there. I can deal with your very flesh. Now they've got these boils all over them. What he's saying is, I can do damage to your flesh as well, you know. It's not just annoyance, this is actual pain. I can make this happen. That it happens without warning perhaps indicates that when punishment and death come to our own flesh, it's too late for warnings. It's too late at that point, right? So let's just take a look at verses 11 and 12 of this particular plague. It says, the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils that were on them and all the Egyptians. So they couldn't replicate it. In fact, the magicians were affected by it, and it was driving them up the wall too. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not listen to Moses and Aaron, just as the Lord had said to Moses. So the magicians, they're also afflicted. And in some ways, I think this is the capitulation of Egyptian religion. You know, these religious men in Egyptian culture admitted defeat. You know, we are defeated. They could not stand before the Pharaoh. There was no more proud standing before the Pharaoh. But the Pharaoh was proud enough on his own to stand against God. And also, for the first time, we read that God hardened his heart. God hardened his heart. I know I've talked about this a couple of times, but I'm just going to dwell on it for a few minutes here. Saying that God hardened his heart is loaded with a lot of presumptions on our mind that we understand what it's all about. A very common way, actually a more common way, when you go through and maybe you look at your Strong's Concordance or if you have one on your computer, a more common way to translate this Hebrew word would be strengthened. The Lord strengthened his heart, okay? And hardened is kind of reading into it, oh, it's bad. But it's very often used in both positive, mostly positive, and negative ways. God strengthened. So you could translate it that God strengthened Pharaoh's heart. In other words, he strengthened his resolve to resist. So God strengthens the heart, but then Pharaoh takes it in a bad direction. I'm going to put my ribbon in here, take a look at just one example of hundreds. Psalm 27, the same word is used very differently. Psalm 27, verse 14, for example, says this, wait for the Lord, be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. Same word, strong, strengthened. When God says to Moses and he says to Joshua, be strong and of good courage. Same word. God made Pharaoh's heart strong. And Pharaoh had decided which direction he was going to take it in. So he had all this courage and resolve. He took his courage in a bad direction. Right? Pharaoh's the one who chose to apply the strength and will and resolve and put it in an evil direction. Okay, won't say any more about that. The seventh plague, hail. Now things start to get, they really go to a new level with this one here. Hail, and there's also an offer of shelter. So now God's offering them a chance, a decision. Let me go back to where I was there in Exodus. So let's pick it up in chapter 9, verse 13, the plague of hail. I'll just read a couple of verses on that. In verse 13 through 15, it says, then the Lord said to Moses, get up early in the morning, confront Pharaoh and say to him, this is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says. Let my people go so that they may worship me. For this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you and against your officials and your people, so you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth. For by now I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with a plague that would have wiped you off from the earth. I could have already destroyed you people. Aren't you getting this? The plagues are not the full force of my wrath. You're not responding to the little things, you know, even beginning with the small thing of the, you know, the staff that turned into snake. You're just not responding. You're not hearing. This isn't good. It's going in a bad direction. What he's saying is, you know, your stubbornness is what causes the stakes to increase. And for the Egyptians, going back to the very beginning, the first message that Moses and Aaron would have had, this is going towards a terrible conclusion. Can't you see that I could have killed all of you by now? Again, you know, at the outset, Yahweh had warned Pharaoh that he would go so far as to claim the life of the Pharaoh's own firstborn son. It was going in that direction. And now with this plague, human lives are going to be at stake. Before it was just animals and stuff. Now human lives are at stake. Verse 14 tells us that God is doing this as a warning to all humanity. This is so people will know. You will all know. Now, let's pick it up in verse 16, and I'm going to read through verse 21. It says, but I've raised you up for this and this very purpose, that I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. You still set yourself against my people and will not let them go. Therefore, at this time tomorrow, again, the decree, I will send the worst hailstorm that has ever fallen on Egypt from the day it was founded until now. Give an order now to bring your livestock and everything you have in the field to a place of shelter, because the hail will fall on every person and animal that has not been brought in and is still out in the field, and they will die. Those officials of Pharaoh who feared the word of the Lord hurried to bring their slaves and their livestock inside. But those who ignored the word of the Lord left their slaves and livestock in the field. Humans are going to die with this plague. This is ratcheting it up. But they don't have to. They don't have to die, do they? The Egyptians are given the option to escape death if they will humble themselves and take shelter. Another foreshadowing of the final plague. There's going to be death. People are going to die, but they don't have to die. They don't have to die. And of course, you know, this is setting up the final plague, the death of the firstborn. And it also sets up the message of the Passover, which is that you can avoid the punishment of death if you come under the blood of the Lamb. You don't have to die. And if you don't come under the blood of the Lamb, you will. Let's pick it up in verse 25 of chapter 9. It says, throughout Egypt, hail struck everything in the fields, both people and animals, and it beat down everything growing in the field and stripping every tree. And the only place it did not hail was the land of Goshen, where the Israelites were. Verse 27, then Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron, and he said, this time I have sinned. And he said to them, the Lord is in the right, and I and the people are in the wrong. Pray to this Yahweh, Lord, for we have had enough thunder and hail, and I will let you go. You don't have to stay any longer. So Pharaoh, he knows that he has sinned. Notice the escalation of his, you know, his awareness of what's going on. I have sinned. He knows he's sinned. He knows Egypt is in the wrong, doesn't he? Some of the people in Egypt have responded to this offer that you can take shelter and you don't have to die. Others did not obey, did not do that. You know, they heard this offer of shelter, and they did it, which is good. But did they change as people? Not really. Verse 33 says, then Moses left Pharaoh, and he went out of the city, and he spread his hands toward the Lord. And the thunder and the hail stopped, and the rain no longer poured down in the land. And when Pharaoh saw that the rain and hail and thunder had stopped, he sinned again. So he's repented and sinned again. He and his officials hardened their hearts. So Pharaoh's heart was hard, and he would not let the Israelites go, just as the Lord had said through Moses. Moses intercedes, and when the danger's passed, Pharaoh hardens his heart again. He does not change. The eighth plague, locusts. Destruction is complete. Verse 3 in chapter 10 is where I want to dive into this particular plague. Again, focusing more on the dialogue here. I read through verse 6. It says, so Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh, and they said to him, this is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, said. How long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go so that they may worship me. If you refuse to let them go, I will bring locusts into your country tomorrow, and they will cover the face of the ground so that it cannot even be seen, and they will devour what little you have left after the hail, including every tree that is growing in the fields. They will fill your houses and those of all your officials and all the Egyptians, something neither your parents nor your ancestors have ever seen from the day they settled in this land until now. Then Moses turned and he left Pharaoh. So each plague is pointing towards this final plague, which is death. And the locusts, what they're going to do is they're going to destroy everything that's left so that the destruction and the desolation is complete and total. Now, human beings have a lot of silly notions about death. In a nutshell, you will not surely die. The big lie from the very beginning. Most folks believe, they're not really dead. So take heart. They're not really dead. Their immortal soul has passed on to a better place. For some, that's heaven. For some, it's something else like Nirvana, the happy hunting grounds, who knows what, Valhalla. Or maybe it's a bad place like hell. People don't like to talk about that as much, but maybe they're still alive, maybe they're just in hell. By the way, it's this concept of the immortal soul. But the scriptures tell us that death is permanent and death is complete unless you are resurrected, brought back to life by God. And everlasting life, which is what you need, it's a gift from God that only He can grant. You don't have it. God can give it to you. You don't have it. And the second death that the scriptures warn of in Revelation is permanent and complete, where there is no hope of resurrection. So death, complete. Well, let me pick it up in verse 7. It says, Pharaoh's officials said to him, okay, how long will this man be a snare to us? Let the people go so that they may worship the Lord their God. Don't you realize that Egypt is ruined? Then Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh. Go, was the Pharaoh speaking. Worship the Lord your God, he said. But tell me who will be going. And Moses answered, we will go with our young and our old and our sons and our daughters and with our flocks and herds because we are to celebrate a festival to the Lord. And Pharaoh said, the Lord be with you. If I let you go along with your women and children, clearly you've got a sneaky plan. No, have only the men go and worship the Lord since that's what you've been asking. Then Moses and Aaron were driven out of Pharaoh's presence. Pharaoh knows he's in the wrong. He's already said this. I've sinned. We've all sinned. He knows he has to yield to God. He knows it's coming. He has to yield to this God. But he's still trying to dictate the terms of his own surrender. Now, I'll obey you, God. I'm with you, God. I want to be yours. But here are some things that I want. We don't get that option. We want it. We don't get that option. We have to take God on his terms. Pharaoh, you know, he doesn't realize this, or doesn't want to. And when he doesn't get what he wants, he breaks off the negotiations. He breaks them off rather than doing what he knows he has to do. So the plague's going to be unleashed. Verse 16 and 17 say this, the Pharaoh quickly summoned Moses, and he said again, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Now, forgive my sin once more and pray to the Lord your God to take this deadly plague away from me. So they do. He knows he's wrong, but his will to resist is strong. God strengthened his will. He begs Moses to intercede. Moses intercedes. The locusts go away. Even after begging for and receiving mercy, Pharaoh's heart is hardened and he changes his mind again and he won't let him go. That's the last verse there, verse 20. Next plague, darkness. This is the last plague I'm going to do. Not going to cover the 10th one. I'm going to save that. I think it belongs with the Passover. Darkness. So look, above all the elements of nature, the Egyptians worshipped the sun. You know, we think of the river a lot, you know, because it's a big deal in Egypt. They were sun worshippers. There's a lot of sun in Egypt, too. They were sun worshippers. Alongside the river, the mighty sun powered life. This is the way their whole way of thinking of physical reality was. You know, the sun, the river, this is what life is powered by. What they missed, of course, was that Yahweh, the living God, is the one who powers the sun. So, you know, they're kind of missing a step. This plague, the plague of darkness, marks the end of the third set. Remember, I had those sets of three? And like the third and the sixth, this one comes without warning. True harbinger of death. I think it's a fitting harbinger, like the one right before the final plague of death. I mean, everybody in the ancient world understood death as the final darkness. Just for an example, go to Job. I know this is Bible, not pagan, but this is pretty much how people looked at things and talked about death. Job 10, verse 21 through 22 says, behold, I go to the place of no return, to the land of gloom and utter darkness, to the land of deepest night, of utter darkness and disorder, where even the light is like darkness. This is just the way people thought about death. So darkness is talking to them about death. And 3 days with nothing to do, no light, they couldn't even see anything, they just had to feel around. They had a lot of time to think about what was coming. The promise of death that was built into that first proclamation of Moses. So I'm going to go back to Exodus chapter 10 and read verse 23, where it says, no one could see anyone else or move about for 3 days, yet all the Israelites had light. I mean, God can bend light. It's as simple as that, which is what I see. So darkness is for those without God, right? Darkness is for those without Yahweh. God's people had light. The people of God have light. Let's go to Matthew. I just want to read, there's so many things about light in the New Testament, but we're going to go to the beginning, Matthew 4, verse 13 through 17. It says that, leaving Nazareth, he went and he lived in Capernaum, which is by the lake near Zebulun and Naphtali, to fulfill what was said through the prophet Isaiah. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, the way of the sea belong beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people living in darkness have seen a great light. And those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. And from that time on, Jesus began to preach, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near." And once more, this Passover, you and I will remember the light of God that has come upon you, who were once under the shadow of death. That's a big deal. You've been in darkness. But God's come to you and he's shone a light into you, into your life. And that's good. And we're going to talk about that once more. We're going to walk through that once more at Passover. So let's just finish off this plague by reading in verse 21 through 26. It says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand towards the sky.'" So there's that sign again. "So the darkness spreads over Egypt, darkness that can be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand towards the sky, and total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else or move about for 3 days. Yet all the Israelites had light in the places where they lived. Then Pharaoh summoned Moses, and he said, 'All right, go worship the Lord. Even your women and children may go with you. Only leave your flocks and herds behind.' But Moses said, 'You must allow us to have sacrifices and burnt offerings to present to the Lord our God. Our livestock too must go with us. Not a hoof is to be left behind. We have to use some of them in worshiping the Lord our God. And until we get there, we will not know what we are to use to worship the Lord.'" So after 3 days of darkness, Pharaoh's ready to negotiate again. "Hey, stop this. This darkness is just too much." And he knows he has to do God's will, but he wants to inject some stipulations. And he said, "All right, but you got to do it this way." He's still trying to dictate on his own terms. And we all do that, don't we? We know we have to submit, but we kind of want to lay down some terms. "Well, what about this?" But Moses won't budge. It won't budge. Verse 27, let's pick it up there. It says, "But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to let them go." So he'd said, "You can go," and then now he says, "You can't." They wouldn't meet his terms, and he was not willing to let them go. And Pharaoh said to Moses, "Get out of my sight, and make sure you do not appear before me again." A lot of bravado from this man here. "The day that you see my face, you will die." "Okay, just as you say," Moses replies. "I will never appear before you again." Ominous words. So Pharaoh rashly terminates the negotiations, even issuing this death threat against Moses if he ever shows up in his court again. But before he leaves, and this is important, before he leaves, Moses has some parting words. That's what we read about in chapter 11. Moses pronounces, "Okay, Pharaoh, now it's going to happen. The final plague. The plague of death on the firstborn. All these plagues, all the nine plagues that we've walked through, were all like shots across the bow. You know, they got closer to the ship each time. And you haven't done anything. Now it's going to happen." And I think, you know, it's a message that we can apply in so many ways to our own lives and society at large. God is very, very patient with people. Gives us all kinds of warning, gives us all kinds of time. Because what does God want? He wants us to repent. He wants us to change. He wants us to live. He wants you to live. He wants everyone to live. He wants all those people out there to live too. He offers them shelter even. They don't take it up though. Hopefully you have taken up the shelter, placed yourself under the blood of the Lamb, prepared for what is to come. And that's great. It's God's light. We're going to go through that this Passover, and I'm looking forward to doing it with you.